Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, our final installment of The Matrix, a further exploration. So pop that red pill and please stay tuned. Welcome to the fourth and final installment of our series, The Matrix, a Further Exploration. If you've just tuned in, the backbone of this collage is a fine essay by Richard K. Moore called Escaping the Matrix. The essay is read by Lynn Gurry. Robin Upton has taken that reading and woven around it all manner of other passages that illustrate and complement what the essay says. The essay is now 20 years old, but it has held up remarkably well. For the nature and the methods of corporate capitalist hegemony have not changed. One example, near the end of this installment, the essay charges that Bill Clinton merely pretended to advocate health care reform in order to attract the votes of liberals. In office, he pursued the corporate agenda as relentlessly as any Republican has done. True enough. And to prove the point, Obama did the same. Someday the liberals are going to wise up and proclaim a plague on both your houses. Our previous installment focused on the system's mechanisms of social control. These included militarized police, prisons, destroying the Bill of Rights, and CIA drug trafficking. This week, more mechanisms of social control, including divide and rule generally, exploiting racism specifically, and media propaganda. And then on to the people's incipient rebellion and police crackdowns. The first voice we'll hear belongs to Canadian journalist Peter Dale Scott.
Continuity of government planning, the process by which the U.S. Constitution has already been superseded. In July 1987, during the Iran-Contra hearings, grilling of Oliver North, the American public got a glimpse of a, quote, highly sensitive, close quote, secret that North had been involved in emergency plans to suspend the American Constitution in the event of a nuclear attack. And I'm going to quote from the hearings, and this was printed the next day in the New York Times, but as you listen to it, you may be interested that not one newspaper ever commented on the content of this interchange. Congressman Jack Brooks from Texas, thank God for Texas. Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster? And then North's lawyer jumped up, Mr. Chairman! And then the senator, Daniel Inouye, who was a Democrat, the chair of the committee, responded in a way that showed he knew exactly what Brooks was referring to. And this is what he said. I believe that that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch on that. Jack Brooks, I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency, that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was an area in which he had worked. I believe that it was, and I wanted to get his confirmation. Then Inouye again, may I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session. End of quote. How many people never knew that happened in Iran-Contra? Well, it sort of freaked us at the time, and then it just disappeared from view. We have never heard if there ever was or was not an executive session, or if the rest of Congress was ever made aware of the matter. Reportedly, Congress as a whole was bypassed altogether. Two books say that Congress was completely left out of this planning.
391.
In Mann's book, the program called for setting aside the legal rules for presidential succession in favor of a secret procedure for putting in place a new president and his staff. Alfonso Chardy wrote the definitive story about this back in 1987, and here's what he said. The planning called for, quote, suspension of the Constitution, turning control of government over to FEMA, emergency appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and declaration of martial law during a national crisis. Well, it's absolutely Orwellian to call this continuity of government, when in fact it's obviously plans for very, very radical change of government.
But raw force is only the last line of defense for the elite regime. Neoliberal planners introduced more subtle defenses into the matrix. Looking at these will bring us back to our discussion of the left and right. Divide and rule is one of the oldest means of mass control, standard practice since at least the Roman Empire. This is applied at the level of modern imperialism, where each small nation competes with others for capital investments. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles.
434.
Throughout history, whenever different groups have come into contact, they have interbred. Any attempt to establish lines of division among biological populations is both arbitrary and subjective. Close quote. The biological concept of race has no scientific basis. However, it does serve a political purpose, to divide people by maximizing their differences and minimizing their similarities. Racist assumptions are deeply embedded in the English language. The designations black and white divide people by skin color and exaggerate that difference. In fact, white people are not really white. They are various shades of beige. This can be demonstrated by holding a sheet of white paper against the skin. Black people are not really black. They are various shades of brown, including beige. It would be more color accurate to use the labels brown and beige. Using the terms black and white implies polar opposites, when all human beings are actually shades of the same color. Black and white are political labels, not colors. How natural is the tendency to classify people by skin color? A clever two-part experiment set out to answer this question. The researchers concluded that less than 4 minutes of exposure to an alternate social world was enough to deflate the tendency to categorize by race. Close quote. Racial categories are so artificial that they need constant reinforcing to be maintained. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles. The regime can sit on the sidelines, intervening covertly to stir things up or guide them in desired directions. In this way, most discontent can be neutralized and force can be reserved for exceptional cases. In the prosperous post-war years, consensus politics served to manage the population. Under neoliberalism, programmed factionalism has become the frontline defense.
299.
The question, it's almost like a riddle, is when we all sit down together and gather around the multicultural table, what do white people bring? And the answer, of course, is the table.
The Matrix version of divide and rule. The covert guiding of various social movements has proven to be one of the most effective means of programming factions and stirring them against one another. Fundamentalist religious movements have been particularly useful. they have been used not only within the U.S., but also to maximize divisiveness in the Middle East and for other purposes throughout the empire. The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed.
225.
The moral voice of religious rhetoric in this country, I think, is either going to go the way of a Pat Robertson or the way of a Martin Luther King. Within the Bible, there are narratives which I would call holy war narratives. And that is this whole notion that calls forth the righteous warrior to purge evil out of the land. It's a moral development because, you know, something is happening in society that is frightful and fearful, and it's causing chaos and terror and people are dying. And so in reaction to that, religious legitimation is given for violence. And the religious person, without guilt, without shame, with the kind of conscience that can sleep well at night, will be given permission to purify the land for the good of all, even the good of the enemy that you're purifying. That's what I call the holy war narratives that are embedded in some of the scriptures. Those are the narratives that the Bush administration and the religious right wing in this country are really drawing on in a very powerful and in a very new way, I think. I'll give some examples of that in a minute. The other narrative, the one that Martin Luther King drew on, and I would say Jesus drew on, is what you call the prophetic narrative. Throughout Scripture, there is a storyline that is against empire. It's against the accumulation of power. And the prophetic critique of power, the one that says to the king, we need to limit your ability, that just because you make a decision doesn't mean that that has to be the rule of law, so to speak. And so the prophets arose to critique the exploitive business practices and the overreaching of power by the king, so to speak. And Jesus comes out of that tradition, and he speaks of compassion and mercy and inclusivity and welcoming the sinner, welcoming the unclean, because that's the way to peace, is you create a relational economy and you create a relational politics that reaches out and embraces the concerns of the least among them. Mr. Bush and the Bush administration use Jesus, but then redefine his message through holy war narratives, which Jesus never drew upon. And what we're hearing, the media expression of Christianity, is almost entirely this holy war narrative of purity. And it's driven by two branches. One that I think is very familiar to people, especially those who have ever seen these Left Behind books in stores. One is this apocalypticism, a catastrophic, you know, we're living in catastrophic times. The world is about to come to an end. But there is it's kind of like Freud's Thanatos syndrome. There's actually a desire for the world to come to an end because it's become so impure and things are so chaotic and people are so unrighteous that what needs to happen is a huge purifying of the land. The media expression of Christianity and many evangelical and fundamentalist churches are drawing upon these narratives that we are living in the end times. It's a theology of despair. How that translates, to give a case example, is why bother with the environment? Because we're not going to be around in 100 years. And so it's just not that important to create and build a sustainable society. Another way that translates that I think, again, might be familiar to many folks because it's in the media, and that's this absolute marching in lockstep with the hard right of Israel. There can be no critique of Israeli-Palestinian relationships, and nor is there linkage with the church in America and the church in Palestine. Rather, it's a wedding between the right wing in this country and the right wing in Israel. It doesn't matter what Israel does to the Palestinian people.
The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed. In the U.S., that weapon has been used to promote censorship on the Internet, to attack the women's movement, to support repressive legislation, and generally to bolster the ranks of what is called in The Matrix the right wing. In The Matrix, the various factions believe that their competition with each other is the process that determines society's political agenda. Politicians want votes, and hence the biggest and best organized factions should have the most influence. and their agendas should get the most political attention. In reality, there is only one significant political agenda these days, the maximization of capital growth through the dismantling of society, the continuing implementation of neoliberalism, and the management of empire. Clinton's liberal rhetoric and his playing around with health care and gay rights are not the result of liberal pressure. They are rather the means by which Clinton is sold to liberal voters, so that he can proceed with real business, getting NAFTA through Congress, promoting the WTO, giving away the public airwaves.
193.
The FCC, whose members tend to serve the same class interests as most of the rest of the government, is coming under increasing fire for its giveaway of the allegedly public broadcast spectrum to be the money machines of a few giant corporations who strive to dominate the arena of culture and discourse in the interest of their bottom lines. These media empires are devoted to consumerism and profit-making as the essence of Americanness.
682.
In 1934, Congress passed the Communications Act, sealing the future of America's broadcasting as a for-profit system.
NBC, CBS, ABC, these huge empires, were built upon the gift for free of monopoly rights to government property. It was an extraordinary corporate welfare that boggles the mind.
Giving away the public airwaves, justifying military interventions, and so forth, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I repeat, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. The matrix cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Under the onslaught of globalization, the glitches are becoming ever more difficult to conceal, as earlier with the Vietnam War. November's anti-establishment demonstrations in Seattle, the largest in decades, were aimed directly at globalization and the WTO. Even more important, Seattle saw the coming together of factions that the Matrix had programmed to fight one another, such as left-leaning environmentalists and socially conservative union members. Seattle represented the tip of an iceberg. A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry spot.
Well, they tell me that the world turned upside down. You gotta pick it up and shake it, gotta turn it around. You gotta take it apart to rearrange it.
The protests outside definitely gave the developing country delegates heart. You know, it gave them the encouragement to stand their ground. I think this was the first time the developing countries had felt supported. And I think the protests on the outside gave them the sense that they were right in what they were doing, that they were right in holding out. You know, it gave them the encouragement to stand their ground, and the moral support and the psychological support and all those things that help you stand up to a bully.
Apart from derailing the agenda of the WTO, as a moment, the Seattle result was seminal for the forces of popular globalization. Although the media was to coin the absurd phrase anti-globalization to describe what had happened, for many, the events of that week signaled the birth of a new global justice movement, a new global solidarity, and a new global consciousness.
A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry, scorching day. The establishment has been expecting such a movement and has a variety of defenses at its command, including those used effectively against the movements of the 1960s and 1970s.
19.
In practice, any political demonstration or action where the participants attempt to thwart corporate power is considered criminal activity. The repressive police response to demonstrations in Seattle and Washington, D.C., and the preparations for more of the same at the upcoming conventions are part of a plan first created in the 1960s to preserve order by using military force to suppress dissent.
if for any reason you haven't seen the military violence which is dished out to peaceful protesters who get in the way of the corporate machine, whether it's at an FTAA protest or just because they want to keep their indigenous land or whatever it is, I would encourage you to take a look. That was one of the first things I downloaded with my broadband internet connection, videos which protesters had shot of police running wild with all their riot gear. And that was a jaw-dropping moment for me, just to see, firstly, the violence, and secondly, to realise that there was another world which I was never going to see on corporate media, another whole set of truths. So that was one of the stepping stones that took me down this road of producing the show that I'm now doing. So if you're one of the people who uploaded video, if you felt that the world needed to know, then be encouraged, at least as far as I'm concerned. That was a very important discovery. And whilst we're on the subject of jaw-dropping moments, discovering Alan Frankovich's film about Operation Gladio was a big one for me, to see that NATO had organised a campaign of bombings against Italian civilians for its own clandestine purposes. That encouraged me to rethink what I thought I knew about terrorism, counter-terrorism, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. So let's continue with Silvio Federici from episode 327, exploring, I think, another very important and useful parallel, which I hope will help you to understand why I don't use the word terrorist on Wikispooks, except within quote marks. Now, let's pick up on Professor Moinia Lazrig, whom we heard from in the introduction. This is from episode 327.
The witches were the terrorists of the 16th and 17th century. You know, the witch hunt was, in a sense, very analogous in many ways to what the war on terror is today. For example, the concept of the terrorist is now defined in such a broad way that can be used to persecute many different types of behavior which the state wants to see criminalized. And I want to start my discussion of the witch hunt to say that this, in fact, was the case, you know, with the definition of women as witches, you know, which became the label for evildoer. And under their label, a very large variety of types of behavior could be persecuted, even though on closer examination you can see that those types of behavior were somewhat interconnected, and that, you know, the attack waged on witches as the attack waged on terrorists, and the use of terrorism as a charge, in the end, has very definite objectives it tries to reach. Today, a terrorist can be defined in the United States, according to the Patriot Act, as a person who seems to be trying to influence the policies of the state by their behavior. So, even though obviously there are in the world some people who use terror as a political weapon, clearly under the label of terrorist, many, many people, in fact, probably most of us, can be charged with that. Strikers have been described at times in ways that makes them very close to terrorists, anti-war protesters, and so forth. You find in the persecution of the witches of the 16th and 17th century the very similar situation. The label of witch became a label that was sufficient to have a woman arrested, tortured, and executed, even though no proof of crimes committed might be available.
Robin's collage ends around here. Let us continue with more of Richard K. Moore's essay, read by Lynn Gurry.
In order to prevail against what seems like overwhelming odds, the movement must escape entirely from the matrix, and it must bring the rest of society with it. As long as the matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. The whole truth must be faced. Globalization is centralized tyranny. Capitalism has outlasted its sell-by date. Matrix democracy is elite rule, and market forces are imperialism. Left and right are enemies only in the matrix. In reality, we are all in this together, and each of us has a contribution to make toward a better world. Marx may have failed as a social visionary, but he had capitalism figured out. It is based not on productivity or social benefit, but on the pursuit of capital growth through exploiting everything in its path. The job of elite planners is to create new spaces for capital to grow in. Competitive imperialism provided growth for centuries. Collective imperialism was invented when still more growth was needed, and then neoliberalism took over. Like a cancer, capitalism consumes its host and is never satisfied. The capital pool must always grow more and more forever, until the host dies, or capitalism is replaced. The Matrix equates capitalism with free enterprise and defines centralized state planning socialism as the only alternative to capitalism. In reality, capitalism didn't amount to much of a force until the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution of the late 1700s, and we certainly cannot characterize all prior societies as socialist. Free enterprise, private property, commerce, banking, international trade, economic specialization, all of these had existed for millennia before capitalism. Capitalism claims credit for modern prosperity, but credit would be better given to developments in science and technology. Before capitalism, Western nations were generally run by aristocratic classes. The aristocratic attitude toward wealth focused on management and maintenance. With capitalism, the focus is always on growth and development. Whatever one has is but the seeds to build a still greater fortune. In fact, there are infinite alternatives to capitalism, and different societies can choose different systems, once they are free to do so. As Morpheus put it, outside the matrix, everything is possible. And there are no limits.
And here we must end our show. Our thanks to unwelcomeguests.net for the audio. Our thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, everybody get together, and please come back again next week. Till then.